Richard Cross, on behalf of Frank C. Whittington II, the plaintiff below, an appellant in this case against Dragon Group LLC et al. And I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In terms of the nature of the proceedings, this is a suit on appeal from the Chancery Court in which Frank Whittington sought to enforce his membership rights in the Dragon Group LLC. In that case, the trial court held in summary judgment that the agreement in principle was not a contract under seal, and we have appealed that decision. The trial court dismissed the case based on a laches defense, and we appeal that decision. And the trial court allowed the testimony of Frank Whittington's former attorney, Jay Katz, over the plaintiff's objection. Critical aspects of the testimony that the court relied upon were not disclosed prior to trial. The testimony should have been excluded based on the attorney-client privilege and because of unfair surprise, and we have appealed that aspect of the court's decision. I'd like to give a few facts in background to put the case in context. I don't want to recite what I had in my brief, but I do want to go through some of the facts. The sibling defendants in this case have repeatedly attempted to dilute Frank Whittington's interest in various family-owned entities. Frank's mother, Dorothy Whittington, had a controlling interest in a family-owned entity called Whittington LTD. In her estate plans, she gave her controlling shares, which were voting shares, to the plaintiff, Frank Whittington. 11 days after her death, Tom Whittington, one of the defendants, sought to amend the certificate of incorporation of Whittington LTD to convert those non-voting shares, the other non-voting shares, to voting shares, and as a result, take away the controlling interest that Frank Whittington held. Faith Whittington, who was another one of the sibling defendants, was the executrix of the estate, and she voted Frank Whittington's shares, what were to be Frank Whittington's shares, in favor of this amendment over the objection of Frank Whittington, and as a result, control was taken from Frank Whittington. The parties then ended up in litigation over that and other issues. During that early trial, Frank Whittington's attorney learned that Tom Whittington had then transferred essentially the principal asset of Whittington LTD, which was real property known as Dragon Run, to the Dragon Group LLC in an apparent attempt to take Frank Whittington or have Frank Whittington lose that property right. The parties then entered into settlement discussion and reached an agreement, which led to the agreement in principle. More formal documents that were contemplated under the agreement in principle could not be agreed upon. And ultimately, the defendants brought an action in which Chancellor Chandler found that the agreement in principle was an enforceable contract. The parties continued to negotiate over the form of an LLC operating agreement, but could not come to an agreement on the form of the agreement.
Tom, just at that point in time, does the record indicate what your client contends his interest was worth? And I picked that point in time specifically.
There was, I think, I don't know if it was confusion. It perhaps these siblings, including my client, have difficulty in coming up with that math, but what you saw from the various exchange of documents between the parties was Frank Whittington's interest would be between 23.65 and 24.2% of the Dragon Group LLC.
And what would that be valued at?
I don't think there was never an appraised value for that. It was simply an interest in the LLC, but it was never reduced to a dollar amount.
But this property that was transferred had a value.
Yes, and I don't know what that total value was. I think the parties have suggested it was in the millions, but
the record doesn't reflect it, though.
And I understand that. That's why I'm saying I don't have that number in front of me. But and I don't know if the trial court got to that statement.
The reason I asked is I'm trying to, and I picked that point in time, to try to figure out the amount in controversy, because as the story goes on, which you may or may not tell us, but we read in the brief, we know that later Dragon went forward, borrowed money, paid off another mortgage, and, you know, one of the arguments at the end of the day that the vice chancellor dealt with was the other siblings undertook a risk, and to the extent Dragon has become more valuable, the benefits shouldn't accrue to Frank because he never had anything at risk. But putting all that aside, I'm just trying to understand what's the amount in controversy that ultimately Vice Chancellor Parsons said was barred by latches.
That issue about what the value of that interest was at that time, there is no, I'm not aware that there's any evidence in the record as to what the value is.
How about now? What's your client quantifying his claim to be?
It's simply, again, that percentage ownership interest, but it has not been reduced to a dollar amount. There is no evidence in the record as to what the dollar amount of that is.
Okay.
But I think importantly there, the agreement in principle was clear that Frank was to receive his proportionate interest in Dragon Group and had other things that he had to do. For example, under the agreement in principle, he had to pay over $100,000. And ultimately, when the parties did not come to an agreement on the form of that operating agreement, Tom Whittington sent out a form of operating agreement, which was referred to as the offering memorandum, and that was in September of 2002.
Well, the entire court's read all the facts. Shouldn't we really be focusing on the facts that are most relevant to the latches holding?
In terms of the latches argument, the question is, was there an unreasonable delay in bringing this suit after the plaintiff knew of an infringement of his rights? Now, generally, the court is going to apply a statute of limitations, the equivalent statute of limitations period, but may apply a different period, longer or shorter, if there are unusual conditions or extraordinary circumstances. In this case, in late 2002, there is the offering memorandum in which, notwithstanding the fact that the parties appeared to previously agree that Frank Whittington's ownership interest was between the 23.65% and 24.2%, they then send the offering memorandum out and reduce his interest to 17.7%. Frank does not sit on his rights there. He, in fact, executes the offering memorandum, but corrects in his mind to what he believes is the more appropriate 24%, which is, I guess, in between the 23.65% and 24.2% interest. He executes the stock pledge, and he returns those documents along with $100,000 to the defendants. And the defendants claim that they reject his change in the documentation to what he believes is the more accurate percentage and is consistent with what the defendants previously claimed was his percentage interest.
Well, when we get to the March 2003 opinion, one way to read that is your percentage is whatever was in the overarching agreement. Does the record reflect whether his $100,000 check was ever cashed?
I believe it does. But I don't have the site to it.
Was it cashed or not cashed?
I believe it was cashed, ultimately. Ultimately, they got the $100,000 from Frank Whittington.
So that seems to be a fact worth noting as far as your client's claim that although there was a disagreement about the percentage, that's resolved in 2003 by saying you have to go back to whatever the overall agreement was to ascertain your percentage, he still had $100,000 invested, and he had pledged his stock.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what's important, I think, when it gets to the latches defense is Frank Whittington had not sat on his rights after this argument about the offering memorandum. He went to court and got a ruling. And in Vice Chancellor Lamb's decision, as the court just noted, he says your interest is, you know, whatever it was under that agreement. So at that point, the question is, does Frank Whittington then need to go back to court repeatedly to enforce or get repeated rulings from a court that he has an interest in Dragon Group? Or can he rely on Vice Chancellor Lamb's ruling?
Well, on that, it is correct, is it not, that that throughout these proceedings, Frank's position has been that he's entitled to a roughly 24% interest in Dragon. Is that right?
That's correct.
And the other siblings' position has been that Frank is entitled to no more than 17 plus percent. Is that right?
Yes. The trial court had found that Frank was entitled to the additional shares. There was an issue about 55 shares and 10 shares and whether those would be converted towards.
But what those shares would represent in terms of percentage ownership was in dispute.
That's correct.
And that's been the case throughout, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so when Frank sent his check for $100,000 and his shares, whether justifiably or not, the defendants rejected that proffer.
Well,
or at least they cashed the check, but they took the position that he was not entitled to a 24% interest and that the altered agreement that he sent back was not satisfactory to them.
That's correct.
Okay. Your position is that the consequence of that was to negate any settlement and to restore the parties to wherever they were. At what point?
That's a good question. The issue, I think, is that when the court asked just now whether the defendants continually took the position that he only had a 17-point-something% interest, that is true as of when this litigation that's in on appeal now took place.
I think the critical, since you rely critically on what happened when what we now know was a rejection,
yes,
by the other siblings of Frank's attempt to be included as a member. We need to know what the legal effect of that action was, and then the question is, what did Frank know, and when did he know it? We're still at the first question.
I understand that. Where I was going was that the defendants themselves, leading up into the offering memorandum, took the position in the repeated drafts that they were writing that Frank Whittington had an interest between 23.65 and 24.2. Those numbers come from the defendants' drafts, and it is suddenly when the offering memorandum comes that it inexplicably reduces his interest, which is what leads Frank to take action.
Well, we're here because of the Vice Chancellor's ruling on latches. As I understand it, he admitted the Katz testimony, and there's a dispute in the record, according to you, whether there really was a conversation between Jeff Weiner and Katz or whether it was Boyer, although Weiner's bill or notes say Katz might have been on the conversation. But it seemed to me that we ought to be talking about your position on why the Katz evidence was improperly considered at all, because as I read the Vice Chancellor's ruling, he would say your client's claim is barred by the statute of limitations based on what Katz said. That is, your client was clearly on notice. His siblings took the position. He wasn't in the group before that date in July. Alternatively, the basis for his ultimate holding was latches, in part based on the Katz testimony, Katz evidence, in part based on other things. So putting aside all these percentages, shouldn't we be focusing the argument today on why the chancellor concluded the claim was barred by latches, and to the extent you want to tell us why the Katz evidence should have been excluded, we ought to talk about that, and to the extent it's either excluded or included, tell us why the other evidence doesn't support the latches conclusion. But all of that seems to be focusing on what your client knew on or about July, because that's the date the court focused on for when your client was on notice and did nothing.
It's the plaintiff's initial position that once the plaintiff got a ruling from Vice Chancellor Lamb, notwithstanding, if one accepts the Katz testimony, then in July of 2003, he had a conversation with Frank Whittington and advised him that they didn't accept his, or they were disputing his ownership interest. The fact that they are making that repudiation does not start the statute of limitations in the plaintiff's mind. The statute of limitations begins to run when, if the court is going to apply that statute of limitations, it begins to run when they take some action to actually infringe on his membership rights. His membership rights are things like excluding him from meetings, not giving him his distribution, not allowing him to participate in management. If they jump up and down and say you're not a member, that was essentially decided by Vice Chancellor Lamb's decision, in which he said, no, he is a member. And so until they then do something to violate his member interest, not giving him his distribution, not allowing him to participate in a meeting, not allowing him to participate in management, that's when the statute of limitations would begin. But it's the plaintiff's further position that once the decision...
So you're saying that even if Mr. Whittington, the plaintiff, knew the next day after the event that his siblings had taken the position that he is not a member, he wasn't required to do anything. Any action to enforce that.
If all they did was to tell him that they don't believe he's a member, I think that's right. Until they actually take action that
you mean take further action?
Well, take not just words. It has to be actions. It has to be refusing to give him those benefits that exist under the membership. And at that point, they hadn't done that. And under an anticipatory repudiation type argument, you have a choice when somebody makes that repudiation. You can either immediately go or wait until they actually do something to violate your rights. And the statute of limitations under that scenario doesn't begin until they actually do something to violate your rights. In this case, there already was a disagreement between the parties over whether he was a member, and the court issued a decision in March of 2003 saying he was a member. So until they really did something to exclude him or prevent him from participating or not give him his distribution, the statute of limitations should not run.
There was a dispute about his percentage of ownership as a member, wasn't there?
Well, that certainly wasn't understood then. I think at that point it was.
When did that first raise its head then, in light of the Vice Chancellor's analysis of latches?
Well, I think when the Vice Chancellor said his ownership interest is going to be carried forward, the Frank Whittington anyway took the position, and I think it was a reasonable one to take, that it was going to carry over in the same interest that he had in Whittington LTD. Until much later, the parties didn't have a dispute over what that percentage ownership was.
So your position is that even if Katz's testimony was properly admitted and must be credited, that is, by this court, it doesn't matter. That is, it doesn't charge the client with any obligation to make further inquiry or to do anything.
Until they actually exclude him from a meeting or do one of the other things that would affect his membership right, not give him his distribution, not allow him to participate in management. That's correct. But we have additional arguments that we have made on that are, number one, the Vice Chancellor said this case boils down to a dispute over the agreement in principle. And when the Vice Chancellor made his ruling about the statute of limitations, he based it on a 3-year statute as a result of saying you're trying to enforce rights under the agreement in principle. It's our position that the agreement in principle was a document under seal.
Well, all that argument would do, if we were to credit it, would be to expand the limitations period from 3 to 20 years. But none of that makes any difference or is of any consequence if the action is barred by latches. Because an action can be barred by latches even if the delay, even if the lawsuit is brought within the limitations period.
And that's correct. The court can apply latches to a shorter or longer period than the statute of limitations if there are extraordinary circumstances.
Aren't we back to Justice Holland's point that we ought to be talking about latches?
Well, and our position on that is he didn't sit back on his rights. He took that action to go to the Chancery Court back in 2002 and received the 2003 opinion. He was entitled to rely on that, and Vice Chancellor Parsons said he was entitled to rely on that. So in relying on that, he didn't need to do anything until there was some further action by them barring him from his membership rights. And we believe that that didn't occur until much later, probably until the April 2004 when they issued a letter to him saying, you're not a member and the K-1 issued to you was an error.
You're in your rebuttal time. Did you want to save it?
I will make one last point with respect to the JCATS testimony. It's our position that not only should it have been excluded because of the attorney-client privilege, which we raised. We raised the attorney-client privilege issue in that the court found that there was a broad-based waiver because there were documents from an arbitration dispute between JCATS and Frank Whittington over his fees. And the exhibits from that were provided to Tom Whittington from JCATS. As a result, then, after the arbitration, Tom Whittington gave them to Frank Whittington, and in the presence of one of the other sibling defendants, Frank then turns it over to that sibling defendant at their request, and the court said that constituted a waiver of the privilege and was broad-based. But if one looks at the testimony of JCATS, the testimony, if one reads the exhibits that caused the waiver, you do not discern from that there was a July 2003 telephone conversation. And so the only way they got to the July 2003 telephone conversation was not because of those documents. It's because they had multiple meetings. The defendants had multiple meetings with Frank's former attorney and as a result learned of that alleged telephone conversation. So the attorney-client privilege, even if there was a waiver, shouldn't have been as broad as it was. And in addition, the plaintiff specifically asked in discovery for any such conversations. The defendants knew about it in advance of trial and didn't disclose it. And importantly there,
And would that be the night before trial?
Well, the JCATS's initial testimony was that it was a week before trial and later said he wasn't sure when it was. But either way, the defendants had previously put on Dorothy Minotti, who provided surprise testimony, and the defendants were aware that the plaintiffs were upset about the idea that they had not amended interrogatory number 7. And then they put JCATS on the stand without giving any advance warning to the plaintiffs. In this case, you have Jeff Boyer, who's a potential witness, because Jeff Wiener's records say Jeff Boyer was on the phone. You have Jeff Wiener, who's a potential witness on that, who had testified 2 days earlier, so he was no longer there. And you have the time records of Jeff Wiener, which we don't actually have. We just have an email from Jeff Wiener as opposed to time records. I only have about a minute left. I'll try to reserve that. I will reserve that for rebuttal unless the court has any other questions.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Richard I.G. Jones, Jr., on behalf of the defendants below, appellees, that's Dragon Group, LLC, Thomas Whittington, Richard Whittington, Faith Whittington, Dorothy Minotti, Martha McDermott, Sarah Whittington, Ruth Whittington, Matthew Minotti, and Dorothy Minotti. Your Honor, for ease of reference, I'll just refer to those all as the siblings, if it's okay. One thing I thought I'd just quickly address is a question from Justice Holland about the $100,000 investment. That payment was through the agreement in principle, and it was $10,000 for stock and limited and $90,000 for a loan a repayment of a loan that was taken from Frank's mother back to her estate. Just want to make that clear that it wasn't a direct investment into Dragon.
No, but it was part of the overall global settlement, we'll call it, that ultimately was going to have Frank involved in Dragon at some percentage.
That's right, Your Honor.
He was to do certain things. Took him a while to do them, but and then he was to have a percentage of Dragon.
That's right, Your Honor.
So was there anything, putting aside the disagreement about the exact percentage, was there anything else he was supposed to do that he did not do?
Well, we would contend that he needed to enter into an operating agreement or to, you know, formalize the process. There was a long period, and this is a real estate investment. I think we have to keep in mind that, you know, the family wanted to move forward with the investment, and it was delayed for a significant period of time. As the court found, it was Frank's pattern of delay that delayed it. So we would say, yes, he had to enter into some documentation and really just sign on and move forward.
So if we look at the record, what's the record's support for your client's position that Frank's just not in Dragon at any percentage?
I think the record support was that he counteroffered on the operating agreement, and that we'd said we're going to move forward after the state, and we rejected the counteroffer and didn't move forward. Now, arguably, that was all, you know, at least addressed in Vice Chancellor Lamb's 2003 opinion.
All right. So your opponent tells us the way he reads Vice Chancellor Lamb's 2003 opinion is Frank is in. It's just he's in at the percentage set by the AIP. But your client's position seems to be, notwithstanding Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion, your client was still not in at any percentage. So how do you is it a fair reading of Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion to say Frank's in but at a reduced percentage? Or after Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion, what's the basis for your client to say Frank's not in at any percentage?
Sure, Your Honor. I think the basis for our saying that is that, like I said, he didn't return the appropriate documentation. He counterproposed on the documentation. He didn't, and that his offer to tender stock was tied to this proposal. At trial, Frank was unable to give us any manner in which he came up with that 24% number. We think it was much lower.
Well, let me parse my question
Sure.
a little bit. The first is, what did Vice Chancellor Lamb say? Is it a fair reading of his position that in Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion, Frank was in, but at a reduced percentage?
I think that focusing on that one sentence in Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion, and looking back now, you could give it that interpretation. However, at the time, Vice Chancellor Lamb actually denied Frank's motion, closed the case, and our clients, you know, regarded that as a victory and
well, they
forward.
Did, but the victory related to percentage, not exclusion. And that relates to this latches argument, because Frank's position is, I might not have been in at the percentage I wanted to be in, but Vice Chancellor Lamb basically held, I'm in at whatever percentage the AIP said I'm in for. So if we take that as the starting point, and that's why I want to parse it, then the question becomes, after Frank has this ruling from Vice Chancellor Lamb, you're in, but at the reduced percentage from the AIP, the question is, what did he do thereafter that let him sit on his rights when your clients, for want of a better term, simply disavowed Vice Chancellor Lamb's holding and still took the position Frank wasn't in at all?
Well, Your Honor, I guess I'd take issue with the disavowing the opinion. The court found that we had a reasonable interpretation of that opinion and that we had won and that everything remained the same, which was we were going forward with the Dragon investment and developing the property. And we told Frank, Frank was at least on notice almost immediately after that was our position.
Well, I thought your position was we're going forward without you anyway. And that's what was communicated by Weiner to Katz, according to you.
What was communicated from Weiner to Katz is that you're not a member because you didn't tender your stock, that you counterproposed on the settlement, on the operating agreement. And so, in other words, our clients believe nothing had changed. They were still back in with the rejection of the operating agreement from October. And they were moving forward with their investment. They've been held up for quite a while on this. Frank had gone to court and lost, just in their opinion. And they moved ahead with the investment. But they made it clear to Frank that he wasn't a member from that point on. And we would agree with the trial court's holding a ruling in that regard. That what effectively happened was, I think, the way the trial court applied or the effect that the trial court gave to Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion was effectively told the statute to say that, you know, he was on notice. He would have been on notice back in October, November of 2002, and I think they admit that in their papers, but for Lamb's opinion. But I'm going to toll the statute as of then. Then we'll look at what happened after March 4th. So I guess that's to say that that we took the position that he wasn't a member, not that he had a percentage and we weren't agreeing with that he wasn't a member because he had not failed to comply with the admission requirements that we had put down. And the reason we put down those admission requirements is because we needed to have a hard and fast date. It dragged on for a very long time, and we said, you're in or you're not, and he, in our view, didn't comply.
Of the $100,000 that Frank sent, you said $10,000 was for shares. Was that an LTD?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
And the $90,000 was to repay his portion of a loan. Was
That's
that a
correct,
pre-existing
Your Honor.
Obligation that he had?
It was a pre-existing obligation that he owed $190,000 to his mother. And in the settlement, that was reduced to a $90,000 payment.
So there was part performance of this settlement?
Yes, there was, Your Honor.
And if it had been fully performed, then Frank would have been a member.
I would take issue with that in the sense that had it been fully performed, the performance would have been required Frank to join Dragon Group and follow the formalities.
Well, what's confusing to me is that qualifying language is not in Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion. Is that simply because that issue was never joined? But the way Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion ends, it's you're in it, whatever percentage is in the AIP. And you keep saying that what the opinion really meant to say was, if you're in at all, you're in at the percentage in the AIP, but you may not be in if you haven't done certain things. But you don't get any sense from Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion that there was even a possibility he wasn't in at all. The only dispute was the level of percentage of participation.
Your Honor, I think that what the party, I think it really, what we're really focused on, what effect Lamb's opinion had on the parties. I realize looking back that you can take that sentence and say he's a member of Dragon, but from our client's perspective, I'm not saying that that's in the opinion. It's what they understood, which really was that Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion didn't change their perception of.
Well, you say that. But when we're talking about a case involving latches, it would seem to me if your client's position was, we don't care whether he thinks he owns 23% or we think he owns 17%, because he's not in anyway, because he didn't do X, Y, and Z. So while we're having this dispute about percentages, it's really irrelevant because he's just not in. And yet, Vice Chancellor Lamb decided this as if it was important to know the percentage of participation because he was going to be participating. So my point is, when we talk about what people know, what they didn't know, latches, detrimental reliance, part performance, if it's your client's position was the percentage was totally irrelevant because no matter what Vice Chancellor Lamb decided they simply didn't care, and because it was their view, Frank hadn't done X, Y, and Z. Why wasn't that told to Vice Chancellor Lamb?
Your Honor, I don't think that was at issue in the motion for performance by substitute. That position was taken after they'd moved on. Now, granted, that was during the time period, but I think we're talking about the effect that Vice Chancellor Lamb's decision had, and our clients had taken the position shortly after the return of the operating agreement that had been a counteroffer and that Frank wasn't in.
So
and
tell me, why was it your client's view that Vice Chancellor Lamb's decision was a victory for them? What had they won?
It was a victory in the sense that Frank's motion was denied and the case was closed. And
what did that mean to them?
To them, it meant that the issue was behind them, that
and
the
what
issue
was the
over.
Issue?
The issue was whether or not Frank could force a membership interest. I mean, he was trying to get a particular operating agreement entered, and the court denied it. So, and the trial court found that we'd conferred with counsel and that we'd reached the reasonable conclusion that we could move on.
Well, isn't it more important what Frank's understanding was than your client's? In terms of the latches analysis?
That's right, Your Honor. I think that is right. In terms of a latches analysis, it's the reasonableness of Frank's belief. And actually what the court did in the tolling in the summary judgment decision was said, it might have been reasonable for Frank, after receiving the March 4th opinion, to form the belief that his, or to have an expectation that his siblings would admit him. But that put a burden on him, I think, to show at trial that he did have that expectation, that there was a tolling. But the court actually never, in the post-trial decision, didn't actually require that. It just found a tolling. Frank did not put on any evidence of what his interpretation of the decision was. And there was evidence, as we know, from Professor Katz and from the engagement letter with Professor Katz, that in May or July, Frank's opinion certainly changed, or at least what he believed his siblings' position to be. There was a controversy at that point. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
I guess.
Would you agree that the selection of the 3-year statute of limitations as opposed to a 20-year based on the word seal to the right of the signatures on the agreement that would make a difference in a latches analysis?
Your Honor, it's an interesting question, actually, because certainly if you're outside of the analogous statute of limitations, the case law is such that you don't perform a prejudice analysis. If you're inside that time period, then it may be still a shorter period, depending on things like prejudice and the reasonableness of the delay. So I think it would only make a difference insofar as what standard you were looking at, whether or not you're looking at reasonableness or not. And so that would be the only difference.
Well, I may be the only one interested in the answer to this question, so bear with me. I thought we interpreted contracts by their plain language, and we didn't read into contracts what the parties hadn't placed there. Now, some of the parties are lawyers, and next to their name is the word seal. That has meaning under the law. Why do you look beyond the word seal to determine if there's a 20-year statute of limitations on the enforcement of that document, or 3 years because it's not a specialty contract? This was an entity that owned real estate, and it was all about an interest, ultimately, in real estate. Documents are often under seal that relate to interest in real property. That's common law tradition. True, most of the time it's mortgages or promissory notes, as the Vice Chancellor said, but at the heart of it is an interest in real estate. Why is it not expected to take at face value the word seal across from the signatures of the people who executed the document?
Your Honor, I think the only answer I can give you is that our case law says that if it's not a mortgage or a specialty document, that you need to have some other form of intent, some reflection of the intent.
Well, the vice chancellor refers to, by way of example, a mortgage or a promissory note. I didn't take that as a limitation, that it's only mortgages and promissory notes. I think common law and think that if the interest at the heart of the document is real property, why doesn't the word seal next to these names, A, be expected to be there, and B, be interpreted for what it says on the face of the document, that it is a document under seal?
Your Honor, I would just say that as recognized by our case law, you either need to have something in the body of the document that gives that intent, that shows that intent, or extrinsic evidence of intent. And Your Honor, I think is maybe saying that the extrinsic intent may be self-evident from the nature of the transaction, that it's real estate.
I don't know what I'm saying if you're trying to reach the view that I have some conclusion, because I don't. I'm simply asking the question, and I'm trying to figure out what people need to be more on notice that this was a document under seal than the word seal there, when the specialty transactions that the vice chancellor referred to are rooted in real estate, as is this document. What more do you have to read from the text of the document itself, or what extrinsic evidence, in addition to the fact that it's fundamentally tied to a real estate interest, do you need to determine that it's appropriately a document under seal and that there's a 20-year statute of limitations?
Your Honor, I would say that there needed to be something in the body of the agreement, and that the fact that there wasn't, given that lawyers drafted it and executed it in some cases, would indicate actually that they, had they wanted to, they could have, is the argument.
Oh, yeah, they could have said, hello, world, we're going to put seal next to our names in just a few minutes, and what we really mean when we put seal there is that it's a document under seal. They could have said that. But my point is, why do they have to say anything more than, this is the agreement we've reached in regard to our relative interest in real property?
Your Honor, one thing I guess I'd point out is that the agreement didn't just pertain to the agreement in principle we're talking about that has that seal language. It pertained to some estates, some repayment of funds to estates, and stock in Whittington Limited. It wasn't just straight out for Dragon Group, which was the real estate entity.
But it is correct that the real interest at the heart of the agreement was the relative relationship of parties who were joint owners in some business form of a real estate interest.
That's true, Your Honor. At the heart of it was a real estate transaction.
Mr. Jones?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir.
I understand that one of the primary questions here is what effect, if any, to give to Dr. Katz's testimony, and I think we understand the logic and the outcome if Dr. Katz's testimony is given effect. But what if it isn't? What if we would agree with the other side that testimony should not have been in evidence at all? How does that affect your position,
Your Honor? I guess there's some evidence left of Frank's notice, and that would be the fee agreement letter or the engagement letter of Professor Katz, which specifically references the AIP and talks about litigating matters that were settled in other cases.
Well, if Dr. Katz's testimony is hypothetically stricken from the record, then what is the effect of that in terms of giving notice or putting his client, Mr. Whittington, on inquiry notice?
The effect of the engagement letter?
Well, whatever the record is, whatever the evidence is other than the Katz testimony.
I would just say the engagement letter would be evidence that Frank discussed with counsel litigating under the agreement in principle in May of 2003, which would suggest his notice in that time period. We'd also point to the August 2003 stockholder meeting at which Frank was excluded and told he was not a member of Dragon.
And we also have the April 14th, 2004 letter from Tom Whittington saying, we sent you the K-1s on Dragon in error. You're not a member. So there would still be those.
So your position is that the outcome is not affected, even if we were to disregard the Katz testimony?
The outcome is not affected, Your Honor. That's correct. The only thing that would be affected is that Professor Katz's testimony, other than the engagement letter, which is separate documentary evidence, placed Frank's notice outside of the 3 years, and then we don't get to the prejudice analysis.
Now, with regard to the waiver of the attorney-client privilege, is it your position that one of the fees in dispute was Katz's phone conversation with Wiener, and therefore, to the extent that was part of the fee dispute, it was waived? Would we find that in the record somewhere?
Your Honor, at the beginning of Professor Katz's testimony, the siblings walked Professor Katz through the documents that had been declared the waiver had been found as to. Those were Frank's fee petition, and they were also Professor Katz's response in the fee petition. And we set up the parameters of the scope of the waiver there. So within that scope was Professor Katz's discussions with Frank about the AIP.
No, I understand that.
Yeah.
But for Latch's purposes, the operative conversation was with Wiener. And my question is, was Katz's non-payment or payment, however you want to characterize it, for legal work, did it include the Wiener conversation?
That was part of the legal work that was part of the fee dispute, yes. I mean, in other words, that's what he was seeking fees for that.
So is that what you rely on to say there was a waiver?
No, Your Honor. We rely on the fact that the fee dispute addressed, the fee dispute communications addressed Professor Katz's discussions with Frank concerning enforcement of the AIP, concerning the global settlement that led to that telephone conversation between Wiener and Katz, so that subject matter was waived. In other words, it was within the scope of the subject matter waiver that was found.
I'd like to get back to the decision of Vice Chancellor Lamb for a moment. That was only a few months before these other discussions that the attorney-client privilege issue relate to, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And if I understand Frank's position correctly, his attitude was, I had gotten a judicial ruling, so I knew I was safe in terms of being a participant at some level, although arguably we still had stuff to litigate down the road on what that percentage was. And as I understand it, the court here basically looked at Dragon moving forward and getting into risk situations and getting mortgage and doing business as having created some latches grounds for prejudice or a reason why Frank should not be allowed to have sat on his rights. And what I'm asking is kind of the opposite, and it may be inappropriate, but if you could answer me, even though I know your time is up here, why doesn't it work the other way around in the sense that, you know, your client was moving forward on a venture after a judicial decision saying that there's another participant in this, or arguably saying that there's another participant in this organization, and they certainly knew that Frank was not, you know, agreeing to their view of things. So to the extent that they went forward anyhow, wasn't that just part and parcel of the years and years of acrimony that's the way this family does business?
Your Honor, I would just argue that the trial court found that our clients had a reasonable interpretation of the lower court's the March 4th opinion, and therefore didn't act improperly by moving forward. And looking at the reasonableness of each party in that circumstance, they moved forward. They did so for years. They did put their stock at risk. They did put their money at risk. And Frank never came forward until two months before the income stream from the Dragon Mortgage to Limited, which he was a recipient of, was about to dry up. And in essence, as the court found, he treated Dragon as an option and instead you took the income flow from the debt instrument, but then as soon as it looked like Dragon was going to succeed, he looked for the upside participation. So I guess I'm saying balancing the relative reasonableness the reasons for the delay that our client would come out in the balancing on that one.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess. Oh, I'm sorry. You do have 1 minute left. I apologize.
I'm the one who made it.
I always follow Justice Berger's lead. She told me we were about finished.
I just had two brief points I wanted to make. One was the issue about what the percentage ownership was. And at the time the parties were litigating in front of Vice Chancellor Lamb, the defendants took the position that notwithstanding their offering memo that said 17.7%, I think, that they in their minds, although they hadn't disclosed it to Mr. Whittington, to Frank Whittington, said in their brief at Appendix 639 of the appendix to here, an additional amendment was contemplated to reflect the additional shareholdings of plaintiff and corresponding membership in the LLC at 23.65%. So the defendants took the position in front of Vice Chancellor Lamb that his ownership interest was 23.65%, would have been. In terms of the latches, I just want to address briefly that there is no prejudice in the plaintiff's view. There was a stock pledge, and Frank Whittington gave his stock, although ultimately the defendants' stocks, which were pledged, were never used as collateral for anything. There was a capital contribution, which we characterize as nominal. But even if there was, the LLC agreement that they claim was in place did not call for a loss of your membership rights in the event you didn't make a capital contribution. In other words, it said it was purely voluntary on the part of the member. It didn't require it. It didn't make it mandatory if the other members were making a contribution. And that's the LLC agreement that the defendants are claiming is the one in place. And I apologize, my time is up. All right. Thank you.
Now, I needn't repeat myself. We're in recess.